This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Concerns are mounting in the tiny southern African kingdom of Lesotho after the brazen killing of the nation's army chief earlier this week. The troubled, tangled relationship between political leaders and the military is prompting fears of yet more instability.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details next. Also, a Tanzanian opposition leader who was shot and seriously wounded yesterday is now in a hospital in Kenya. And under a program run by the UN Refugee Agency, about 300 refugees in Tanzania used public transport to go back to Burundi. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, concerns are mounting in Lesotho after the killing of the nation's army chief earlier this week. The troubled, tangled relationship between political leaders and the military is prompting fears of yet more instability. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The killing of Lesotho's army chief has alarmed the nation's neighbors and prompted concerns in a country with a history of military coups. On Tuesday, armed officers burst into the office of the nation's army chief, Lieutenant General Kwantle Motsamotso, and shot him dead. The assailants, officers who were the lead suspects in the 2015 killing of the previous army chief, were killed in a subsequent shootout. The Southern African Development Community was quick to condemn the incident as a barbaric and heinous act and sent a team to investigate the situation. Finance Minister Moketsi Majuru said he thinks the assailants wanted to punish the general for not protecting them from an investigation into the killing of the previous army chief. He doubts they were attempting a coup.
This is subject to confirmation by intelligence in the future, but for now I think Lesotho is calm.
In 2014, the military was part of the coup that pushed then-Prime Minister Tom Tabane into exile after just 2 years in power. Tabane was re-elected as Prime Minister in June with a promise to reform the security services. Majuru agrees those reforms are an urgent priority for the new government, but says they were never going to be quick.
You should appreciate that within the Lesotho Defense Force, there was a cabal of soldiers we consider quite dangerous, soldiers that have committed crimes that would not have just easily rolled off and allowed themselves to face criminal prosecutions. So there was always need for caution.
But others disagree. The Vice Chancellor of the National University of Lesotho, Professor Nkosi Mahau, says regional mediators in the government should have seen a clash coming and acted sooner. Mahau is a surviving brother of Lieutenant General Maparankwe Mahau, the army chief killed in 2015. In these troubling times, he says, his family feels a surprising emotion.
We feel saddened by their death because our healing was going to come from a court process where they would be able to answer why they did what they did onto my brother, but also did it in the brutal fashion that they did.
Regional investigators are due to deliver their report on Tuesday's killing to Lesotho's government next week. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A Tanzanian opposition leader who was shot and seriously wounded yesterday is now in a hospital in Kenya. A spokesman for the Chadema party told the Associated Press that Tundu Lissu was airlifted to the Kenyan capital early today. He has been shot multiple times near his home after speaking at parliament. Police say they're looking for several assailants who shot Lissu from their car. Lissu has been an outspoken critic of President John Magufuli. The first group of Burundian refugees in Tanzania returned home yesterday under a program run by the UN Refugee Agency. The UNHCR says about 300 people used public transport to go back to Burundi. Around 12,000 of the more than 240,000 Burundian refugees in Tanzania have signed up for the voluntary repatriation program. Hundreds of thousands of people fled Burundi after political violence erupted in April 2015. It was triggered by President Pierre Nkurunziza's announcement that he would seek a third term. Recently, Nkurunziza visited Tanzania and, along with President Magufuli, called on refugees to return to Burundi. The U.S. military says it launched a precision airstrike in Somalia yesterday, killing one al-Shabaab terrorist. No word on the militant's identity. It says the airstrike occurred near Barawi, about 270 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu. On Wednesday, the U.S. military had announced a drone strike that killed three al-Shabaab members in the Bay region west of the capital. Uganda's government and law enforcement officials have faced criticism following the murders of 21 women over the past 3 months. Officials have sought to reassure the public, but doubt remains. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Between May 3rd and September 4th, the bodies of 21 women have been found in two different towns, Katabi and Nansana, not far from the capital, Kampala. Officials say many of the victims had been raped, strangled, and mutilated. To date, 44 suspects linked to these murders have been arrested. Half of them have been charged in court, including two alleged masterminds. That is the latest information delivered to lawmakers Thursday by General Jejo Odong Abubakar, the Minister for Internal Affairs.
In the case of Nansana, 8 were victims of a gang of serial killers who sought to find blood and body parts to help them in their ritual practices. In the case of Katabi, also, it was a case of murders in relation to ritual practices.
General Bakar said 18 of the killings were linked to witchcraft, while the other three women were killed as a result of domestic violence. The Speaker of Parliament had demanded an explanation from the government, suspending parliamentary business for 2 days this week after the body of another woman was discovered near Kampala. Bahati Francis only discovered the body of his wife, Nakasinde Aisha, the seventh victim, after a three-day search. He says he found her fingers and feet cut off, and he could not identify her. He says when he was about to leave the scene of the crime, he saw a part of her skirt that had a yellow flower not soaked in blood, and that was when he identified her. He says at that moment, he went into shock and lost consciousness for an hour. Their seven-month-old baby wails as he wakes up from a nap. Aisha left behind three young children. Police have come under fire from critics who say law enforcement has focused too much on targeting political dissent and not enough on fighting crime. Winnie Kiza is the leader of the opposition in Parliament.
As Parliament have appropriated funds to police, there is no budget of police that have thrown out. The best they can do is to buy tear gas. Right, Honorable Speaker, it is unfortunate that we sit here, all of us, including those we thought would be in power, we are all seeming helpless.
In response to the killings, Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda said what he called backward tendencies, like ritual killings, remain a reality in the country and the government must address the issue. Not everyone agrees with the government's assessment of the crimes. Margaret Chomhanji is a legislator and the former head of investigations into human sacrifice for the Ugandan government. She says law enforcement should not rule out other possibilities.
Every sacrifice, they are very associated to purity. They take bodies that have no scars, young children that have not, in their view, not seen tongues of babies. But we never encountered a rape before the murder.
Both the Ministry for Security and police continue with parallel investigations into the murders. Communities in and around the capital have launched neighborhood watch programs, patrolling streets with police and checking cars at roadblocks. For now, Ugandans pray that another woman's body will not turn up in another bush. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You are listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Concerns are mounting in Lesotho after the shooting death of the nation's army chief earlier this week. A Tanzanian opposition leader who was shot and seriously wounded yesterday is now in a hospital in Kenya. And officials in Uganda are trying to reassure the public following the murders of 21 women over the past 3 months. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. A number of European officials have visited Libya this week, probing the possibilities of a political solution. This included the foreign ministers of Italy, France, and Britain. They met with Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, General Khalifa Haftar, and other Libyan political rivals. However, according to Claudia Gazzini, Libya analyst at the International Crisis Group, the three European countries are not in agreement about what is needed to reach a political solution. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I don't think that Paris, London, and Italy are really working for a political solution for Libya. I think the visit of the succession of these government representatives indicates that they're all trying to secure their relations with Haftar, secure what has been until now panel conversations, and bring them to a level where this is official. But I'm really not sure that the tensions, for example, between France and Italy over the Libya file have really been smoothened to the point where we can say that they are working together for a political solution.
So you believe that the three European countries are not on the same page on what's needed to reach a political agreement in Libya?
Nominally, these three countries agree that there still needs to be a political solution, but unfortunately there is still no concrete project on the way to proceed. Some countries, I think it would be fair to say that France is one of these, appear to be backing more the solution of an election sometime soon, and possibly in the next 6 months. And the Paris meeting that was held last July seemed to indicate that this is the roadmap that they would support. The Italians, as far as I understand, are not very supportive of the idea of elections because they find them impractical. They don't think that there is a legal basis or framework to hold elections, and think that it is more realistic at the moment to try to heal the sort of divided institutions, continue to support Sarraj until the moment is right for elections. So yes, there are still divisions. We're still some way away from having a consensus plan that can be put on the table.
The French minister had also announced the gradual return of the French embassy to Tripoli and his country's pledge to provide funds to the UN-operated stabilization fund, which supports pressing reconstruction projects. Could that strengthen France's role in sealing a deal with Libyan rivals?
No. I mean, a number of embassies in the recent months have been talking about returning to Tripoli, and as you know, also the UN has been talking about a gradual return to Tripoli, and I think it's a good sign. But, declaring that one intends to move to Tripoli and actually doing it is something different. But just the intention in itself of moving back to Tripoli is not a sign of anything substantial. And as I said, yes, there is French support for a political project, but everything in Libya is undermined by the divisions amongst Libyans themselves and also amongst the international community. So there will really be no political breakthrough until you have a convergence of positions between the Libyan actors, between the international actors, regional actors. But also we should add that there will be no political solution unless we also bring on board progress in a security sector dialogue and in stabilizing the Libyan economy. It doesn't end with politics, and it doesn't start with politics. The process to stabilize Libya has to be political, economical, and security linked together.
That was Claudia Gazzini, Libya analyst at the International Crisis Group, speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. China is hosting a summit for those who ratified the UN treaty to combat desertification. Experts are discussing the drought situation in Africa, which they say has been made worse by conflict and poor land management. They are also discussing protecting, restoring, and managing the world's dry lands, which include savannas. The health of dry lands is linked to food security and climate change mitigation. Dr. Jonathan Davis is coordinator of the Global Drylands Initiative for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature from Ordos, China. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about the importance of drylands.
First of all, drylands cover 41% of all the land on Earth. In Africa, it's getting closer to about two-thirds of all the land. They're important environmentally, of course. They have about a third of the global conservation hotspots, about 28% of endangered species. But they're also important for people. More than a third of the population of the planet live in the drylands. And again, in Africa, the number's much greater. And when it comes to poverty, 90% of the poorest people in the world live in the drylands of developing countries.
So when you look at these drylands, you're very concerned about their being protected and also restored. How can that be done?
I mean, restored, yes. Protected, yes. But I would also say sustainably managed. Considering how important these lands are for so many people, key is to manage them sustainably. At a local level, of course, that depends a lot on the land management practices. You've got people using them for crop farming, for wood harvesting, for livestock production, and so on. There's a wide range of practices that are pretty well known, pretty well established for sustainable pasture management, for agroforestry, conservation, agriculture. Actually, the solutions are quite well known and they're quite widespread. Many of the most sustainable practices are practices that have been used in the past and have been lost as a result of well-meaning but often misguided efforts to improve food production. And what's happening is now some of those systems are being revived, adapted, and maybe modified in some ways, but based on a lot of traditional knowledge and a lot of tried and tested approaches.
Now, are you making this call because dry lands are now under threat? Have we lost a great amount of dry lands?
Well, we have. I don't think dry lands are necessarily more under threat than other parts of the world. I mean, the data's a bit shaky, but I mean, we're estimating somewhere between a quarter and a third of all the dry lands are being affected by degradation. There is a disproportionate amount of the world's poverty in dry lands. So people are more dependent on natural resources, and therefore their degradation has more serious implications. But also the dry lands, again, perhaps related to that poverty, they're places where a lot of the population growth is projected. So there's going to be growing demand for natural resources, people increasingly exposed to threats, to risks like drought. Obviously, droughts are ever present in the dry lands, but with growing population and degradation of the natural resources, droughts are becoming more of a threat. And at the same time, people's ability to deal with that threat is declining.
How are your concerns being received at the summit in China?
In general, very well. I think many of the parties, many of the countries that have signed up to this convention share these concerns. The convention over the last couple of years has adopted a target land degradation neutrality, essentially by the year 2030, to ensure that there is no net degradation of land resources. Now, that's a really big rallying cry, if you like. Many countries are now setting targets and developing action plans to mobilize quite large-scale initiatives to respond to these threats. I mean, there are still a lot of challenges, particularly around evidence of what the real state is, evidence of where the needs are greatest. You know, it clearly needs a big push. I think the issue of land degradation is globally important because it determines food security, water security. It has a big impact on climate change, biodiversity loss. And yet it's kind of a forgotten environmental issue.
When you talk about a big push, are you talking just about money or other factors?
Of course, money is part of the solution. But there needs to be a big push in terms of leadership, political leadership, national and global leadership, to push this up the agenda. The Sustainable Development Goals, with a number of targets underneath them, one of them is land degradation neutrality. So you're competing for space in the global and in the national agenda, and you're competing with other incredibly important issues like health, like education. If you address land degradation, actually you're cutting to the heart of many of these other issues, because land is the basis of so many of the services, if you like, that the environment provides to humanity.
Dr. Jonathan Davis is coordinator of the Global Drylands Initiative for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature from Ordos, China. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa. The summit on desertification runs until September 16th. Some Zimbabweans in South Africa breathed a sigh of relief today. The government reversed a decision to not renew their special residency permits. Tens of thousands of Zimbabweans entered the country illegally seeking work. Tuso Kumalo reports from Pretoria.
South Africa has decided to extend the residency permits for nearly 200,000 Zimbabwean economic migrants by 4 years. Their current permits were set to expire on December 31st, which had raised fears of mass deportations. Home Affairs Minister Hlengwe Mkhize said the government is extending the permits due to worsening economic conditions in Zimbabwe. She stressed that they are one-time extensions, not a path to permanent residency.
I trust that the ZEP will go a long way in assisting the Zimbabweans to rebuild their lives as they prepare at work, in business, and in educational institutions for their final return to their sovereign state, Zimbabwe, in the near future.
As many as 1.5 million Zimbabweans have migrated to South Africa in recent years, seeking to escape Zimbabwe's chronically struggling economy. The extended residency permits are available only to nearly 200,000 Zimbabweans who were granted amnesty in 2010. Those who are eligible must show proof they have a job. Still, many Zimbabwean migrants are breathing a sigh of relief. Economic conditions back home have left many of their families dependent on their remittances they send. Kabuto Mapena is the chairman of the Zimbabwe Community in South Africa organization.
We had hoped, though, that the minister was going to include those undocumented Zimbabweans that are working in South Africa. But at the same time, we welcome this statement. We are calling on all holders of the Zimbabwe Special Permit to apply within the time set by the minister.
Relations between Zimbabwe and South Africa have hit a dip in recent weeks due to unrelated issues. Pretoria's decision to grant Zimbabwe's First Lady diplomatic immunity after her alleged assault on a woman while in Johannesburg is being challenged in a South African court. And this week, President Robert Mugabe publicly attacked the late Nelson Mandela for presiding over a reconciliation process that Mugabe criticized as leaving whites still dominating the economy. Mugabe's statements have drawn anger from South Africa's ruling ANC party. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Pretoria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.